You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at stdave.org and click on the podcast button.
Very good. All right. Well, welcome again. Like I said, we're happy to have you. This is Dr. Mona Wells. You all may know her as our Director of Adult Formation. And you've been here for...
March 1st will be 2 years.
2 years in March the 1st. Holy cow. I've been napping too much. I've been almost into 2 years. Her credentials for this job are spectacular. She has a PhD from Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. Ironically, in small world, she went to school with my brother-in-law, who is a Baptist pastor. She has a PhD in Old Testament, Hebrew Scripture. I'm going to ask you just to talk a little bit more about your background, because I think most of us know you as organizer of Adult Formation, but tell us you.
All right.
Okay.
Well, welcome everybody. Thanks for being here. This is a great group. This has been really fun. Thank you. Well, I grew up Southern Baptist, and...
all the best Episcopal.
Yes.
It'll all be perfect.
You know, part of that growing up was being exposed to Scripture, and one of the things I love about the Episcopal Church is the emphasis on Scripture. The Baptists had that too, and of course I'm a vacation Bible school graduate. I don't know if you remember sword drills. So I grew up with
a militaristic image.
a love for Scripture, and I went to Louisiana College, which is a Baptist college in the middle of the state, to study psychology. I wanted to be a religious counselor, and we were required to take 2 Bible courses in our time there. And I loved my Old Testament course, and so I changed my major to a religion major. I was one of 2 women who graduated from Louisiana College as a religion major. And this was back in the 70s. And I knew that I wanted
before
to teach.
Before electricity.
Yeah. Before the internet. Yeah. I knew I wanted to teach Old Testament. That just, I loved the courses. I was really influenced by my professor. And so that's what I did. I went to Southern Seminary, which is at the time was a great school, probably one of the most progressive of Southern Baptist seminaries, and got an MDiv there and also a PhD in Old Testament. And my first teaching position when I finished my doctoral work was at Austin College. So Roy Malugin, his Old Testament professor there at the time, was on sabbatical, so they needed somebody to teach his classes and also to be assistant chaplain to the college. And that chaplaincy work was what led me down a pastoral path. They really wanted me to be ordained to do that work. And I went back to the Baptist church that I attended while I was at seminary and asked for ordination, and they ordained me. So I was one of the very few women who was ordained in the Southern Baptist tradition. I still have my ordination certificate because they bought it at the Baptist bookstore, and they had to use liquid paper to blot out all the places where it said he, him, I've been, she, her. So talk about pronouns. So I went from Austin College, that was just a 1-year position, to a tenure track position teaching biblical studies at Anderson College in Anderson, South Carolina. And right around all of that journey came this other little interesting piece, which was realizing that I was gay. And so it's like, okay, so what am I supposed to do with this now? Eventually that journey led me to leave the Baptist world. It was hard enough to be a woman, an ordained woman in Baptist life, much less a lesbian. So I left Anderson College, and at that time I discovered Metropolitan Community Churches, MCC. So I got involved with them, transferred my ordination credentials to MCC, and wound up being the academic dean of the school that they had at the time. This was in the late 80s, early 90s. There was still not a lot of places where folks could go as out LGBT folks to get a theological education. And so we provided that for them. And this was before the internet, so we did distance learning, you know, with fax machines, and phone, and mail. So I did that for a while, and then went on staff at a large congregation, much like this one in Dallas, the Cathedral of Hope, and was pastor of spiritual life there. And the work that I did there is very similar to what I do here. But when I came into MCC, that really freed me up, come out of the closet, that really freed me up to begin writing and publishing around what does it mean to read the Bible as an LGBTQ plus person. Because historically, our relationship with the Bible had been pretty much a defensive one. You know, we do those clobber passages, those texts of terror, you know, quite well. And it was important to me to think about what is our relationship to the Scripture beyond having to defend ourselves against those few passages that may or may not have something to say about homosexuality in the Bible. And so that really is kind of what put me on the path there. What does it mean then to just read all of Scripture through an LGBTQ plus lens? So I don't know, that's just kind of a short version of my journey, but kind of out of that then, I was asked to contribute articles to different journals, and Bob Goss, who is my co-editor for this second edition of the Queer Bible Commentary, he and I published a book in 2000 called Take Back the Word, A Queer Reading of the Bible, and Hilbert Press, who was the publishing arm of the United Church of Christ, published that book, and it was basically selected readings of Scripture, and then we did the first edition of the Queer Bible Commentary, which was actually the whole Bible being commented on.
Very good. So you've published extensively in what now we're describing queer biblical hermeneutics. And, I mean, and maybe one of the first to publish in this particular, this targeted area of study. So there are two words in there that I want us to unpack a little bit. First of all, hermeneutics. Let's make sure everybody knows what that is. So tell us what we're talking about.
Well, hermeneutic is the science of interpretation. So it's like it's the work of interpretation or interpreting text. So, I guess you could say that about, we were talking about history in a sermon this morning at 9 o'clock, but the interpreting history or interpreting text, so it's the science of interpretation. And historically, that has up until 20 or so years ago, in the biblical world, that was done mostly by white, cisgender, European,
mostly
Western,
German.
Yeah. So part of my path too around queer biblical hermeneutics was to first engage feminist hermeneutics. This feminist.
You said in our conversation with Brevity, you called that you used the word, and I just lost it. When you a specific location, or what? What was the word you used?
Right. Yeah. A social location.
Social.
Yeah.
Say a little bit more about that.
You know, in seminary, we were taught about exegesis. You don't read anything into the text. You don't do eisegesis. You do exegesis. It's like bring the meaning out of text. And around the 1980s, a shift happened in biblical studies that really focused on the reader. You know, that readers make meaning of biblical text. And yes, there's meaning that the author intended in the text, but there's a lot that happens with the relationship between the reader and the text. And so this term, social location, was developed really to talk about that. But basically, we are readers that come from particular communities, and so our gender, our sexual orientation, our race, our class, all of that brings to bear on how we appropriate Scripture and read Scripture. And so the New Interpreter's Bible commentary that was published back in the 90s, it's not new anymore, but at the time, they did a whole volume on social location and the importance of reading the Bible as African Americans, reading the Bible as Asian Americans. I mean, these are chapters in that first volume, reading the Bible as Native Americans. And I remember being at a Society of Biblical Literature conference the year that first volume came out, and a colleague of mine had a copy, and he said, you know, there's a chapter missing in here. And it was, where's the queer social location? And so next year at the Society of Biblical Literature, I presented a paper on reading the Bible as queer Americans. And social location.
All right. Yeah, it makes me think, just an observation, that's how we consume anything. I mean, it's how we consume art, it's how we consume music. I mean, all the things that we read it from a place, and that interaction, and I think all artists know this, there's the intent of the artist, and then there's those who receive the art. And there's a turning loose of it at some point, where then the meaning is made by the one who's seen it. And I think that's just true. So I think what this movement has done is just taken away the myth of objectivity. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't remove scholarly discipline. I mean, obviously, knowing what it says really does say, what it really did mean in that place and time, vitally important, so that we're interpreting the right art. But then, if you're going to consume, I mean, that's every sermon in the world is what we're talking about, right? A sermon tries to translate the there and then into the here and now. Okay, you've used the word queer hermeneutics. Be specific about how you're using the word queer in this context.
Yeah. It's important for marginalized groups of people to have the power of naming. So often marginalized groups are named by others, by the dominant culture, and so part of what the activism, I guess, of marginalized groups is to take back words that have been used to objectify or to name. So you saw that in the African American community, taking back the word black. And so in the LGBT community, it's taking back the word queer. So queer has been a derogative term, it's been used against our community. And so we are taking back that word, claiming it in order to rename or name ourselves. And the way that word is used it's almost like it's used in a verbal sense. It's etymologically, queer is not related to query, but that is how it's used. To queer something is to query it, is to question it, is to push back against it. So to queer history or to queer the Bible is basically to question heteronormative readings of texts, or to question how LGBT people have gotten left out of the interpretive enterprise, or out of history, or out of literature. So it's that questioning and that querying. There's also, I think, a playful layer to queer something is often to camp it up, or to be playful, or have playful readings or understandings of stories. And so there's some of that in queer Bible commentary as well. But it really has to do with this idea of the power of naming and taking back the word. And I will say that even in the queer community itself, there are some folks who still don't like the word, you know, and aren't interested in taking it back. And typically, that has to do with older folks, folks who are older, who really did grow up with that word.
They used to hurt them.
Yeah.
And they had
yeah.
been hurt by that.
Yeah. Right.
Well, and I will say, as a cisgender male, it's hard for me to say it out loud, but I feel like I'm being insulted. You know, I don't want to make sure that it's like other disparaging terms that have historically been disparaging. Just out of perspective, and I don't want to yell. I think that's an important attachment to this, so that we understand. So let's get to the text itself. So this is it, y'all see it, it is, it's, so there is a section, it's a commentary on every book in the Bible, right? So this is really a source document. So if you're doing the Bible study, say you have a small group who wants to do a Bible study on the book of Ruth, then you would grab this along with other resources that you might have to explore the book of Ruth and read that again. And so it's a companion of each book. But they're not laid out like chapter, verse, like first, you know, 1-1 to the end of the book. It's more of a broader thing. So my question is, when you started compiling this, you had to decide who you were going to invite to write and how you were going to instruct them. You know, this is what I'm actually looking for. And then I think the most difficult, you know, is what to include, but what to leave out. So just in that process, like, how did you decide who to invite? Let's start with that, to be contributors.
Yeah. Well, SCM Press, and they're based out of the UK, approached me first to consider writing or editing the second edition, because the first edition had been published in 2006, and a lot has happened in the world, but also in biblical scholarship and in queer theory. And so they wanted, and the first edition was been a pretty good seller for them. And so they wanted to do a second edition, and they said, you could either just, we could just kind of republish the first edition and you could do some kind of updated introduction, or this really could be a second edition where you have new writers and also give people who contributed to the first edition an opportunity to update their essay. So that was our starting point, was to go to the folks who contributed to the first edition to say, having a second edition, are you interested in rewriting, your updating your essay? And so, I'd say, I don't know, maybe about half said that they would update. And the other half either were too busy or had died or so, but that gave us opportunity then to invite some new voices. And what was important to us was to have a diversity of voices, even among the LGBTQ community. And so we've got folks, the first edition was fairly U.S.-centric. And so this...
So fairly what?
U.S.-centric.
Oh, U.S. I'm sorry,
yeah.
I just didn't know.
Yeah. So this second edition has contributors from Brazil, Mexico, Australia, the UK, Canada. So we've got not only the diverse of trans voices, one rabbi who wrote the piece on Exodus. So that was really important to us, is to try to have that diversity of voices. I'm trying to think, in the first edition we did have pastors, students, as well as academicians. I think in the second edition most of the folks are academicians. And the way we invited them was just that we knew their work. I mean, part of the work of being an editor of a volume like this is sort of knowing the pulse of the scholarship that's out there and who are new voices, who's been publishing in the area. And so Bob Goss and I just put our heads together to brainstorm about who's been doing what in each of these areas. And so Bob edited the New Testament and I edited the Old Testament. We worked together to come up with ideas about who we want to invite, you know, to write the commentary on Genesis or Judges or whatever. And in some instances, we carried over the essay from the first edition into the second edition. I mean, there were a couple of instances where folks didn't have the time to rewrite, and we couldn't find anybody to write, like judges as an example.
Judges is a collaborative text for everybody.
Yeah.
It kicks all us.
So we've probably got a handful of chapters that just were, I said, duplicates from the first edition.
So did you win, and I guess this is really a question of first edition, or the ones you invited later, the new authors for this one. Parameters, any kind of parameters, or just you said this is what we're doing, and did they already know kind of what that meant, or did you give them something?
We sent them a copy of the chapter from the first edition, just let them see kind of what, you know, what the flavor of the writing was. It's not like they had to do exactly what just done in the first edition, but so they had that as a template, just stuff like they had parameters around numbers of pages, so, you know, like that.
But content-wise, no guidance of sort of where you wanted it to go?
No, not really. Either reading from a queer perspective, so like what does it mean to you to read this book of the Bible with a queer lens, or what is it like for you to read this book of the Bible applying queer theory? Because there's also a whole layer of a discipline that has to do with queer theory that looks at things like the construction of gender and sexuality in society, and the performance of gender. And so so there are some writers that sort of took that path, and other writers who looked for themes that would resonate for the LGBT community, like coming out, or I know we have time, we might get into this in a minute, but like I wrote the...
You wrote the book, nobody wanted to go.
I did the essay on Esther. I wrote on Ruth, Esther, and Daniel. And in Esther, I explored the theme of clothing and cross-dressing, because Esther, really, I talk about Esther as like a drag queen. I mean, you know, she's the queen, Queen Esther, but she was also in drag, I mean, because she, you know, wore the Persian robes, and so clothing figures really prominently in the book of Esther. And so that's just an example of like, so I just kind of ran with that then. Exaggeration is also very prevalent in the book of Esther. And so I talk about camp as an exaggeration with regard to identity. And so what you have going on in the book of Esther is, what does it mean to be a Jew under Persian rule? And so there's a way, you know, to weave these themes, but still have it be relevant to the history and the context of the book. So it's not just like, you know, you're just kind of making up stuff, but there was really an intersection there for me. So that's just an example of the kinds of things that we were looking for from the writers and contributors to the second edition.
Right. So you mentioned that you did Esther, but so Ruth, Esther, and Daniel, I mean, that's your... Were those books in particular part of your PhD work, or I assume that you were the contributing editor, you got to pick which ones you wanted to write.
I wrote my dissertation on the Book of Ruth.
Oh, okay.
So my doctoral dissertation was on the Book of Ruth. And what's been interesting about that is, just to kind of go back and see, my dissertation was on a literary feminist reading of the Book of Ruth. So, you know, I'm this little closeted lesbian, you know, at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, writing the Book of Ruth. You know, so the best I could do was a literary feminist reading, and I had three white cisgender men on my dissertation committee. I mean, I managed to get all the way through Southern Seminary with not one female professor. I mean, 2 degrees. And I mean, they had just started hiring some women when I finished my doctoral work. But when I came out and started exploring biblical hermeneutics, that really freed me up to explore then, what is this relationship between Ruth and Naomi? You know, we always hear that passage in heterosexual marriage ceremonies, entreat me not to leave you or to return from following you, for where you go, I will go. Ruth says that to Naomi.
Yeah. It's a very strange that it's ever read in a marriage between a man and a woman for all kinds of reasons.
Right.
But that's the particular one. It just shows our never-ending ability and willingness to jerk Scripture out of context.
Right.
And make it say something it's not saying. Because it wasn't about marriage. It wasn't about heterosexual marriage for sure.
Right.
I'm glad you said, because I've always constructed that myself.
Well, it was a statement of devotion. And I mean, I really don't go there in my commentary on Ruth. I mean, in terms of, was this a lesbian relationship? I mean, I don't say that. I mean, I don't think I can prove that. But I think it's to explore how one woman really devotes herself to another woman. I mean, Ruth is they're both widows in this society, and in the ancient Near Eastern society, women were only valued as child-producing in the husband's household, or virgin in the father's household. And so women were marginalized. And so what does it mean that this one woman who is marginalized, who is a foreigner, devotes herself to another woman? And so looking at things like, we're told, in the first chapter, I talk about how Ruth comes out on the road from Moab to Bethlehem. She comes out as being devoted to her mother-in-law. And we're told that after Ruth says what she does, that Orpah leaves. You know, two of them are returning. Orpah leaves, and of course we don't hear anything about her in the rest of the book. But we're told by the narrator that Ruth clings to Naomi. And the only other time the Hebrew word for cling is used is in Genesis, when we're told that the man leaves his household and clings to his wife. So I look at things like that, in the book of Ruth. The only time the word love is used in the book of Ruth is at the end, when the townswomen say, a child has been born to Naomi, your daughter-in-law, Ruth, who loves you, has borne him for you. And the other thing that I do in Ruth, and this is really where I focused my work, is in the book, there are laws that are referenced, like the levirate marriage law, and the law, and these are laws in Deuteronomy that have to do with the care for widows when the husband dies and there's no heir. But they're very ambiguous in the book of Ruth. I mean, they're mentioned, but they're very vague the way the narrator references them. And so interpreters over the years have talked about how these laws really become kind of a backdrop for the plot. So the characters actually act above and beyond the letter of the law to create chesed, or loving kindness or faithfulness. And so what I do with that, with Ruth, is to talk about how LGBTQ, and this was before marriage equality when I wrote it for the first edition, how queer folks have done the same thing. We have used the legal system and loopholes in the legal system, like things like durable power of attorney. This is before marriage equality, or power of attorney, wills, those kinds of things, to create families of choice. I mean, I think Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz basically create a family of choice, using and manipulating the laws of their day. And so I draw some parallels with the way LGBT folks have done that. Current times. So that's just a kind of overview of what I do.
Well, keep going with the others. If you've got time, do Esther and Daniel. Tell us sort of the way you were thinking about each one of them as well.
I'll just say a few more things about Ruthie first. So when I updated my essay for the second volume, the second edition, the areas that I added were around immigration, because Ruth is a border crosser, and so looking at themes of immigration there. But I was fascinated when I was doing research on the update of the second edition, that there's a whole movement called UndocuQueer of young people who are immigrants, who are undocumented, but they're queer, and they're working for immigration rights, and they struggle with some of the same issues that Ruth did with regard to immigration status, whether it's, if they're married to a same gender person, then that there are issues around their immigration because of that. And so I do a little bit of looking at that whole movement when my rewrite or update on the Ruth. For Esther, I think I mentioned looking at the function of clothing in the book of Esther, and cross-dressing, one of the things that in queer theory, talking about camp or cross-dressing, drag, a woman by the name of Marjorie Gerber wrote a book called Vested Interests, and talks about transvestite, trans and cross-dressing. And she says that that camp or cross-dressing, it's a third thing. It's like it's not male, it's not female, but it's a third thing, and it creates a space of possibility. Or a mode of possibility. And so I really work with that in the book of Esther, once again, looking at the historical context of Esther. What does it mean to be a Jew in Persia during the time that the book was set in that period? It wasn't written during that period, but it was set in that period. And so how this Esther's cross-dressing as a Persian king, how did that create a mode of possibility, a third thing, in order for the Jews to survive in that story? Also, Esther is part of the Megillot, or one of the five scrolls that are read during festival occasions in the Jewish liturgy. And Esther is always read during the Feast of Purim. And of course, Purim is at the end of the book of Esther. It's a new holiday that they create, Esther and Mordecai do, in celebration of the liberation of the Jews from their enemies. But even today, Purim is a kind of a big Mardi Gras kind of celebration, where when they tell the story, every time Haman's name is told, everybody hisses, nice sounds. And so some LGBTQ Jewish folks talk about Purim as sort of like a gay Halloween. So I sort of do a little bit of with that at the end of the book.
One thing you just said just made me remember this week, I think it was yesterday, I listened to the interview with the second gentleman talking about the work that he's doing on right now. What he said was he thought the big thing about him being second gentleman was that he's the first second gentleman. He was the first man in that role. Right? This is the first, the vice president's husband. Sorry, let me make sure we're done. Vice president of the United States' husband. and so he thought that was going to be that's the curiosity, for him. But he said it's actually because he was the first Jew. That's taken so much more of his energy, and it's been so important to the Jewish community.
Yeah.
I mean, like when they did, he did a reading at a recent feast day, I can't remember which one he said, but they, like, just with his group, boy, they had 10,000 people watching this because it was such a... So you were talking about them being, how do you be a Jew in Persia? And I think that is a question that Jews have been asking basically since their existence. How do you be a faithful Jew in the middle when you are not the dominant culture?
Mm-hmm.
And the dominant culture oppresses a Christian. So I can see why that would have a real clear check and connection.
Daniel, I focused on just sort of the queerness of the book in general. I mean, the book of Daniel is half of it's written in Aramaic, half of it's written in Hebrew. And we really don't know if Daniel was a historical figure or not. So I just kind of explore that kind of from a queer perspective. That this, isn't this queer? This book is like this.
It is a queer story.
Yeah, that's all sorts of things. All these, like, many-headed beasts and things. Fiery furnace, that's right.
Yeah.
I focus on eunuchs in the book of Daniel, because Daniel is characterized as a eunuch. And queer history or queer folklore, there have been writers like G. Ron, and more recently Christian Di Roberto, who wrote a book called Coming Out Spiritually, where he really traces sort of the spiritual history of LGBTQ folk, and that in tribal cultures throughout history, that queer people have been characterized and have functioned as shamans and priests and keepers of beauty and boundary crossers, mediators between worlds. And that in the biblical text, eunuchs often function in that way. Eunuchs are sexual minorities, and so they cross boundaries between the common people and the court. They're mediators, they're messengers often. And so I explore that in the book of Daniel, which interprets dreams. And so pose the question, could Daniel be one of our queer ancestors, his role as a eunuch? And a woman by the name of Catherine Ringrose, who's a scholar, wrote a book several years ago called The Perfect Servant, where she really explores the whole culture of eunuchs in the Byzantine Empire, and that their eunuchs were cultivated as a class as perfect servants to serve in the court. And so so I unpack a little bit of that in Daniel, and consider Daniel then as a perfect servant. So that's sort of where I went with Daniel.
I'm interested in the contribution of this work into the greater field of biblical exegesis, and I'm also interested, I just think it might be a good thing for you to, and we talked about this, a little thing for you to reflect on. How is this why should a non-LGBTQ person have this in their biblical studies?
Well, I think
not just in the library, like open it.
Well,
I
just like
on my
library shelf. See how progressive I am. I think it's important as people. I mean, I think for anybody who is serious about Scripture, who is an interpreter of Scripture, either as a preacher or a reader, or even from a devotional perspective, that it's important to know about and hear from voices who have been left out of the interpretive enterprise. I mean, I have books on my shelves of African-American biblical scholars, feminists, And so Asian American, I mean, post-colonial, you know, writers and liberation theologians. And so I think it's important work to know those voices and to know how those communities read and appropriate scripture. I think it's we have a responsibility, I would say, as members of a dominant culture to do that. I mean, I have that responsibility as a white person, you know, to know how people of color read and understand these texts quite differently than I do. It's just it's a responsible biblical scholarship. And as an ally, I think it's important to know how queer people understand these texts, or a dimension of what a queer reading of a particular text would be or look like. And of course, you know, obviously just since an empowering text for the LGBTQ community. I mean, I know your question was, you know, why should a non-gay person, you know, be interested? And I'll tell just this quick story. The first edition, I got word this summer that the first edition had been translated into Korean. Mm-hmm. So, and that happened, it was sort of a organic grassroots movement. There were queer people who were gathering, that gather every year in Seoul for Gay Pride, and were getting pushback from conservative religious people saying, you know, the Bible teaches against homosexuality, you know, we don't want you having Gay Pride, that kind of thing. And so some Presbyterian pastors began doing the work of allyship for this group of people. And the Queer Bible Commentary was very helpful and important for them in terms of understanding how queer people read and interpret scripture, but also being able then to use that in rhetoric that kind of pushes back against the conservative interpretation of scripture. And so they began the work then of translating the English text into Korean so that the queer community within Korea could have this text available to them. And so they crowdsourced it, funded it on their own. And it took them several years.
They didn't trust Google Translate.
And what was interesting was that a lot of the folks who contributed were non-Christian people. They just knew that it was important work. And so they weren't believers at all, you know, they were justice seeking. And so so the first edition is in two volumes. They translated the New Testament first, and then finished the Old Testament just this summer.
I can see another place where it is helpful for me as a preacher and a teacher. And I think anybody that's in a position where you are speaking is to run it through a filter of how might this be heard by someone else? And what am I saying that I'm not intending to say? How might what I'm saying because of my ignorance or my blindness or my own sin be hurtful to someone else unintentionally? And so to have a vernacular and have resources that let you filter your own words. You know, and have colleagues. You know, I could certainly see if I was going to write something that I thought might be edgy or not, I'd come to you and say, how would this be heard in a way? And I'd say, I mean, when George Floyd, we were important for us to say things, but I had to run that through by some really trusted African American colleagues and say, I need you to read this for me and tell me how you hear it, because I don't want to hear. First I want to say what I actually think, and then I want to make sure I say it in a way is not making things worse. Unintentional. This is great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you have something
to add? Yeah, just one piece I wanted to add in terms of the work that I've been doing. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I think when I look at kind of the history of biblical interpretation in the LGBTQ community, I mean, I think I mentioned it early on, kind of defending ourselves against those clobber passages was kind of the first piece of it. I think a second layer that came along was people exploring stories like Ruth and Naomi, Jonathan and David, Jesus and the beloved disciple. You know, what do these stories say about same gender loving people? And then the whole layer of social location, you know, looking at what does it mean to read all of Scripture through this lens. Another important piece of the work that I've been doing is what does it mean for LGBT people of faith to trust Scripture with our spiritual formation? You know, that there's a shift that happens from reading the Bible for information, which is kind of where a lot of our activity has been, to reading the Bible for spiritual formation. And so what does that look like for LGBTQ people to trust being read by Scripture? And so I've done a lot of work around looking at things like queer Lexio Divina. Basil Pennington says that we bring the listening that we are to the text. And so what does that mean for LGBTQ people to bring the listening that we are to the text and have the text read us? And so so that's where I've focused a lot of my work more recently.
Oh, you just made me think of the whole next Sunday school class that we have. The next thing I want to say or ask is just a whole nother bag of worms, because you said, can we trust Scripture? And I think you've got three things. And now you see why you might be suspicious to trust it, because it's been used as such a weapon. That's one use of it. But maybe there are things in Scripture that really aren't things that should be trusted for someone, because of the time and place and the person that wrote it, not just the way we've used it. And then that makes me want to think, and we have to deconstruct Scripture as it is. Like, we think of the Bible as a book, but you all know it's not a book at all. It's 66 books that have been compiled together. Each one has its own story, its own life, and its own authority. So that's our whole math class.
Yeah.
You can know that. This is great. Y'all, please thank Mona for her.
Thank you.
I stepped up all the time. I didn't give y'all a chance to ask her any questions, but if you've got a minute, maybe you can linger or somebody has it. And you can buy this, by the way. These aren't just display copies. These are for sale.
Not cheap, sorry.
And you can buy them from Taylor. No, they're not cheap, but it's your faith we're talking about.
I believe this, the cover is an icon that was painted by a contemporary iconographer, Robert Lentz, and it's Perpetua and Felicity. And so they were two women who were imprisoned together and were martyred in Northern Africa, like in 2203, so that's the second century. But they embraced one another in a kiss as they were martyred. Now, whether they were lesbians or not, I don't know. But their story has become, they're kind of the patron saints, you know, of same gender loving people. So that's what we got here.
Thank you.
This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.